try another one. So. Okay. Welcome to the L4 microkernel talks. On, off? Okay. Actually, we announced this talk as being given in English. Slides are in English, and we were not aware that the other talks are in German. So if anybody is around who is not a native or otherwise German speaker, I would switch back to German. So maybe you could raise your hand if you would like this talk to be given in English. Okay, good. So then I will gladly try it in English. Okay. So let me start with the problem. If you look at conventional systems, you will see that you are overwhelmed by complexity. Take the Linux kernel alone, and you are faced with a system that has at least half a million lines of code, not counted all drivers and stuff that you can configure out of the kernel, but each time you compile a kernel, it will take at least 500,000 lines of code. And, of course, complexity comes with errors, is prone to errors, especially in this another 1.5 million lines of code that are not counted here. So there were studies where was shown that driver code is particularly prone to even severe errors that may shut down the whole systems. Another problem with this kind of kernels, the well-known monolithic kernels, are that all system components run in a privileged mode and thus belong to the trusted computing base. Additionally, it's very hard to engage in local policies. So if you just look how paging is done in the Linux kernel, you have a global page replacement algorithm. It's very hard to craft in another scheme if you want one, if you have special requirements. For the general case, it's probably fine, but if you have very particular requirements, then you probably have very bad chances to get in your own policy. But if you look at the systems, you will easily come to some insights. And this insight is that most of the kernel functionality does not really need kernel privileges to execute. And there are a couple of examples, and the best known, of course, are file systems, driver functionality, user management, like process management, user authentication, and whatsoever. Stepping back another step and asking yourself what's really needing, you will sooner or later come to the following abstractions that really need to be included into the kernel. And you will notice that there's no kernel around that deserves this designation that does not provide some means of threats as activities, a means of isolation, which is normally known as address space. And a couple of primitive operations that glue together these both, so communication scheduling and a safe construction primitive to construct address spaces. What should be observed here is that these basic primitives do not enforce any policy in the kernel. So in the ideal case, it should be your own decision to build a system on top of it, enforcing your own strategy, your own policy. And, of course, all of this should be sufficient. And jumping back into the past, you will notice that the main problem of microkernels we are talking about here had the efficiency problem, so that IPC was slow, that the whole system could not compete with monolithic constructions. But, unfortunately, the perception of microkernel is marred since the mid-80s. There have been large promises, but very few of them have become true. Foremost, they are supposed to be slow. So there have been measurements with Mark and with HERT, which is a Mark-based system, which constantly lags behind Linux monolithic things in performance by a factor or two or so. But as I will show later, it's not true anymore for other microkernels. The second problem is that there's no obvious benefit by a microkernel per se. There was this infamous dispute between Thorvalds and Tannenbaum in the early 90s, where Tannenbaum argued favorably for microkernel-based system with all this flexibility, and Linux Torvalds just didn't care and built this wonderful Linux kernel that was thought of doing everything. But the issue here is how much worth is manageability and a well-structured kernel, and it's very hard to express this in cycles and lines of code, but we think it's worth additional effort and will pay off when enough complexity is accumulated. And unfortunately, we also have HERD. HERD is a classical system of a multi-server built on top of a microkernel. Unfortunately, they took the wrong microkernel, the Mark microkernel. So it's constantly late, it's slow, and it does not provide any functionality that you cannot find in the Linux kernel. But there is a case for microkernels, obviously. The most simple question you can ask yourself is, what do you do with complexity? The kernel grows bigger and bigger, and there's no tendency that this might be reversed in the near future or even in the medium future. You need some kind of structure. You cannot trust 500,000 lines of code when sensitive data is handled or when you need high assurance or high reliability. So you need a structure beyond monolithic kernels, and then there are several candidates which do mingle or have some shared characteristics. So there you can go for full virtualization, you can run several virtual machines, you can do paravirtualization as is lately done by Xen, or you can go for microkernels. And the distinction between these three schemes is how much or what kind of abstractions or functionality you provide beyond the raw abstraction of the machine. And we think that microkernels, with their relatively highly abstracted features, are the most suitable candidates for the job. And it might be the case that functionality is even simplified by using an additional layer underneath your main operating system. So the last presentation was on a real-time executive below the Linux kernel, and it's not the only project that has been proposed in that direction. There's RT Linux, which is also a scheduler and framework that you can put into or underneath the Linux kernel. You have TROPS, which is and system built on top of L4, which I will talk later about. But to notice here is that both Libertos and RT Linux do not provide essential functionality as isolation. So you still have to trust. You may solve the real-time problem, but you do not solve the complexity problem. And of course, security and the only way to go for more secure systems is to reduce the trusted computing base substantially. So the agenda, I gave a short introduction. I will elaborate shortly on L4 microkernels, what they do, how they do it, and then I will describe two systems that were built on top of the L4 microkernel family. So I will talk about the legacy support in shape of L4 Linux, our port of the Linux kernel on top of the L4 microkernel, and about the NHTSA security architecture that tries to address some of the upcoming security issues. So let's start back. Let's start with a look back into the past and look at it. The interest in microkernels is not new. It was first discussed in the mid-80s. And the most well-known kernel of this time was Mark. What they did is they took a Unix kernel, stripped it down, so they threw out any functionality that they thought was not necessary and tried to make it smaller and smaller. But unfortunately, they did not go far enough. They had still stuff in like asynchronous messaging, which unfortunately led to buffer management issues within the kernel. They had a very highly ports concept where you could send messages and had the kernel act on behalf of you. If you send messages to proper process ports, you had virtual memory management and drivers within the kernel, which had the effect that operating system personality on top of the microkernel interfered badly with the virtual memory management in the microkernel. You had a double swapping problem. IBM adopted this microkernel and tried to build or port their own operating systems, the plethora of operating systems they had to support on top of the kernel, and hoped that they could reap some benefits from unifying the code base, and the effects were disastrous. They spent billions of dollars in the effort, and their opinions that they, that this project almost bankrupted IBM in the early 90s. Not to say none of the ambitious goals was ever achieved. The idea seemed to be a total failure, considering that it was costly, that it didn't result in to code reuse or better structured systems. But as a side note, Mark is still alive, and you can find it in macOS 10. If you look in the slide, you will see that you have at the base a Mark and BSD. But unfortunately, the whole motivation of using a microkernel and cutting down the trusted computing base is not taken here. The BSD kernel, a free BSD light server, is co-located with the Mark microkernel for performance reasons. They run in kernel mode. The My guess is they could just kick out the Mark kernel and use a FreeBSD kernel on bare hardware. Probably they cannot do it for legacy issues. Probably the application interfaces are based on Mark, and therefore they cannot just exchange the kernel. But from the benefits they tried to get from this construct, none got into play. So it's not more flexible, it's not smaller. It's to a certain degree, it's pointless. So we have quite a strange situation here, that the second attempt got not worse as it's usually in systems design, but this time the second attempt reversed the direction that the project was heading towards. Jochen Liedtke, a researcher from Karlsruhe and the GMD in Bonn, published groundbreaking results in the mid-90s. He took the opposite direction. He started not with an existing system and cutting out all the stuff he didn't want, but he started with a blank sheet and added stuff only as he needed it. So he published a paper in the 95 SOSP on microkernel constructions, and the whole operating system community was stunned. So basically, he refuted the idea that microkernels has to be slow and inflexible. He came up with a design that only had these three abstractions within address spaces with thread, inter-process communications as mean of interaction, and hierarchical memory management in order to keep policy out of the kernel. At this very time, we have several different flavors of L4 and systems evolved from L4 under constructions. So V2, X2, X0 are names of versions of the interface. And at the moment, there are 9 supported architectures supported by the L4K Pistachio microkernel. This is a microkernel implementation of the Karlsruhe University. So you have Alpha, ARM, IR32, AMD64, and so forth. So the next couple of slides, I will show you some basic constructs in the L4 to give you a feeling how our systems can be built on top of the microkernel, what kind of abstractions you have to deal with. So first of all, there are threads. Threads are mean to encapsulate an activity. They are identified by a thread ID. Depending on the version of the microkernel interface, this is a global ID or a local ID. We are heading towards local IDs in order to be able to impose system-wide communication restrictions. basically, it's nothing more than an instruction pointer, a stack pointer, a register state, including the flags, and the microkernel has to preserve these attributes across thread switches. Note that stuff like an entry point, stack allocation, both size and location, and memory management is not included in the microkernel, but handled by higher levels of system services. Which kind of system services we will see in the coming slides. The unique feature of L4 is the scheme it uses to build virtual address spaces. And what you can do is you have an address space and you can map the right to access a certain page frame to another task. So what you have is you have the microkernel down here. Fiasco is just the name of the implementation that we built in Dresden. You have physical memory frames. You have an address space which has an entry in its page table pointing down to a physical page frame. And what this address space or an activity in this address space can do, it can map this write to access this physical page to another task. So the operation is called send. You put in an F page, which is a generalized notion of a memory region. And the nice property of this scheme is that you cannot enlarge the amount of resources that you have access to, because you can only send pages that are allocated to your address space. If you try to apply this operation on a non-mapped virtual spot in your address space, it's just a no-op. So therefore, the kernel needs only to ensure that the initial state of the system is sane, it's sound, and from there forward, the construction primitive ensures that this property holds for upcoming states. So if you have a look at the system in a steady state, you will see that you have the kernel. You will see that you need an additional part of the system that's not part of the kernel, but a system server. It's denoted here as an initial address space. We call it Sigma Zero. It's booted during the bootstrap, and it's granted by magic all the physical frames in the system. It has a physical memory mapped one-to-one into it, and it maps these pages on demand. So what you have is what's not shown here. You have normally an boot manager, which goes to the initial address space manager, asks for all the physical memory, and then hands it down the hierarchy further and further. So for instance, you have two pages and task that is responsible for the address space layout of another task, and so you map it to page one, and page one maps it down to page three. And during this map operation, you can enforce your own policies. You decide how much memory you map to which locations. And therefore, this policy only depends on the policy that's implemented in pages on different layers of the system. There is an intersection between threads and address space memory management when it comes to page fault handling. So what happens here is if you touch a virtual address that is not mapped to, is that this fault is translated into an IPC, an inter-process communication primitive, which is generated more or less automatically by the kernel as soon as this event happens. And this message is sent to another thread in another task, which we call pager. And this other pager thread is notified first that the event has happened, and second where it has happened, and the properties of the event. So, for instance, if it was a read-only fault, a write fault, or whatsoever. And what it can do is it maps back one of its pages to the faulting thread. So the page fault is totally transparent to the faulting thread. So, okay, we see it here again. So we had a data region and a code region, which both, of course, are also mapped by either this page or another page in the system. We got a page fault. We trap into the kernel. This is an implication of the machine structure. The kernel generates an IPC sentence to the page. The pager has, in this example, a pool of memory pages that can be used for custom purposes and sends back an F page, which backs this virtual address, and the faulting thread continues execution without having noticed that anything has happened. From now on, I want to talk about projects or sub-projects that were done at the Dresden University of Technology. As I mentioned, the original idea of L4 and the predecessor system of L3 is due to Jochen Liedtke, who unfortunately passed away 3 years ago, but the efforts in this direction were not stopped by this very tragic event. So in 1997, Michael Humid at Dresden University started to re-implement L4. L4 is just the designation of an interface. The implementation can be chosen depending on your requirements. At this time, no free L4 implementation was available, only an implementation that was copyrighted by Jochen Liedtke and the company he worked for at this time. Fiasco proved very valuable as a research vehicle, so we extended it to our needs. We put in real-time support and was the basis for all the development efforts we have done so far. The most distinct feature of this kernel is its real-time capability is fully preemptible, which is a prerequisite of real-time. This is achieved by using log-free and wait-free synchronization primitives. It's written in C++, and so far it's available for x86 and ARM, and support for IR64 is in a very rudimentary state, and AMD64 is to come within probably a year. Another remarkable feature of Fiasco is that it's not only a microkernel that you can run on bare hardware, but you have also a port to Linux available. It's in nature similar to user mode Linux, so the techniques and the details are quite different. The nice thing about this is that you have an easy test and development test, but you do not need a dedicated testing machine, but you just can take the binary, start your Linux, and have it run. And it supports all the other L4 projects, including DOPES, it's native L4, native GUI, and L4 Linux, and all the real-time stuff. So here is a screenshot where you have Fiasco UX started as it's compiled. It becomes a statically linked Linux binary. You start it on the command line. It shows you bootstrap messages. It's a little bit misleading. It's not for error reasons that you trap in the kernel debugger here. It's a feature that is because we didn't start it here with proper module information. But to show you, it's on. It runs parallel to a regular Linux system. After having talked a little bit about the very basics about L4, I want to show how a legacy system can be ported on top of L4 of Linux, and how it can be harnessed to use legacy applications in parallel to security and real-time applications. So what you see here is the general structure of such a system. You have some microkernels at the very bottom, which is the only part that runs in privileged mode, with tasks, IPC, and I/O support compiled in. I/O support is a little bit misleading because it only means that IRQs are translated into messages and sent back, so drivers of operating system run in user mode. Then you have a framework of user-level servers that provide for file systems, network stacks, memory management drivers, name servers, etc. And then, of course, you have applications running on top of them, and these applications may either be native L4 applications or legacy applications. The observation again here is the microkernel alone doesn't do that much, so it basically is an thread switcher which enforces isolation and provides a primitive to construct address spaces. But every system, every non-trivial system needs some basic services such as initial task for bootstrapping reasons, a name server to find other services, a memory management, of course a loader that loads components over the network, a file provider to provide file abstractions. And of course you need some programming support within the L4 task. You need something like a libc, a very thin libc, not so fat glibc, but something that provides you with string functions. You need some thread handling to create threads. We do not support POSIX threads so far. We have our own thread library. But since we support fully Linux, we can utilize the Linux POSIX threads implementation. And of course, you need synchronizations, real-time capable synchronizations such as semaphores, mutexes, and so forth. These basic L4 environment is called L4Env and provides all higher-level abstractions of the kernel API that you would need as an application programmer. For legacy reasons, to run also create Linux software, free software that has been around, we ported Linux onto L4. We were asked why we took Linux. The answer to that is that probably at that time when we started porting Linux, nobody had a clue about BSD. So if anybody is interested in doing it for BSD, you are very welcome to contact us. The main reason for having it is, of course, to support legacy operating systems and applications. And this is a key requirement when you come up with a new system, because you will find yourself in an empty desert with no applications, with your simple bootloader and a Hello World application. But this, of course, is not really helpful. What we did is we ported the Linux kernel. So the Linux kernel needs some modification, which sum up to probably 5,000 to 7,000 lines of code. But we are totally binary compatible with Linux applications. We run standard distributions. It was originally started in 96 with Linux 2.0, and the latest is a port of Linux 2.0.26, which is also based on L4Env, and it's not coded against the very raw API of the kernel. The interesting feature here is the Linux kernel itself runs as an application. Of course, we know this from user mode Linux. And the architecture-dependent part is written so that it doesn't use a bare machine abstraction as PowerPC or x86, but uses threads, mappings of memory, and IRQ IPC instead. So here's another picture of the same system. You have the hardware, the microkernel, the system services that provide the Alpha Linux with memory, for instance, and then you take your whole Linux kernel and port it over to run it on top of the microkernel. You have not won anything so far if you just want to run Linux, you have the same problem. The application running on top of Alpha Linux still has this huge trusted computing base, but now the parts of the Linux kernel do not run with kernel privileges, and you can enforce isolation with other parts of the system. So, for instance, as I will show later, you can run security-sensitive applications which do not neither rely nor depend on the integrity of Linux. As in detail, what to do with Linux syscalls. Linux syscalls use on software interrupt x18. What you could do, of course, is you could modify the glibc and use the native syscall, which is sending an IPC, but therefore you need a modified glibc, and it doesn't work for statically linked applications. So what we do instead is we execute the x18, which will result in a machine trap because it's in kernel entry with no IDT entry provided. So microkernel either will reflect it back to the applications or send an exception IPC to the Linux server, which runs the Linux kernel code. The Linux kernel proper will execute the syscalls, so it will do whatever it needs to do, and then send back a message which will unblock the thread that faulted originally in the Linux application. And therewith, you can keep out the Linux kernel from the kernel that runs on the system. We have built a more thorough system on top of L4, which was called the Dresden Real-Time Operating System Abbreviated TROPS, which allows the coexistence of real-time and non-real-time applications. Real-time, so when TROPS was started a couple of years ago, the Linux kernel at much worse real-time property than it has nowadays. So back then it was a real issue. The observation was that many applications have real-time requirements, for instance, multimedia applications or MP3 players, and require proper resource management. The second goal was to use standard PC and network hardware, utilize legacy operating systems and applications for functionality that does not rely on real-time behavior and makes the whole system and the behavior of the system predictable. So if you look at it, you have the microkernel at the bottom, of course, and you have the resource management, which consists of L4, ENV, and some other basic resource managers. And then you have a partition system on top. You have L4 Linux, which provides you, at that time we did not have a native GUI, so we used X at that time, and a ZAP system, which consists of other servers that provide real-time services. So, for instance, the disk driver allows for bandwidth reservation to hard disk. We have own scheduling algorithms and scheduling frameworks for disk requests. The same is for network drivers, so we can guarantee a real-time behavior in switched Ethernet. Now we have a Windows system, and potentially we could use a network protocol, and we have real-time file systems. So, and there are two or three types of applications. Of course, you have legacy applications like editors and compilers that do not care about real-time at all. You have real-time applications like controllers, process controllers, whatsoever, and you have mixed applications with would like to have a real time, but which do not die if they do not have. So this is subsumed under soft real time normally, and the best representative of this class is probably multimedia. So the basic model of TROPS is that you have real-time streams and you can construct networks of consumer-producer streams and stack them together. So, for instance, you would use a disk driver to feed into a file system, to feed into a video decoder and audio decoder, and finally come to the window systems or the sound drivers. Of course, you need a memory manager underneath to allocate some memory and pin it, and a CPU scheduler to provide you with the proper execution time when you need this. What is interesting here is that we crafted our own real-time interface called DSE, stands for TROPS Streaming Interface, which glues together the components. So there's also work about imprecise computations. I will not go into much detail, but the observation is, again, that if you do hard real-time, then you have to go with very pessimistic assumptions and worst-case execution times, which leads to a very bad utilization. And therefore, the idea is that you can split your jobs in a mandatory and an optional part. Of course, we talk about periodic jobs here, that you are guaranteed that the mandatory part is executed in each period, and that the optional part may be interrupted and may not meet its deadline. So an example here is radar target tracking. In the mandatory part, you will see your targets at the screen, and in the optional part, you will refine the accuracy. Another example is an MPEG player, where you can scale down the rate of frames. So you may live well with 15 frames per second, and if you have enough compute time, you can go up to whatever you want, 25 or more. So there's a whole lot of mathematics behind this. There is a rather complex admission algorithm that computes the probability of the optional parts being executed, and you are offered an agreement that says that your mandatory part, of course, is it's executed always, but the optional part only with a probability of, let's say, 85% or so, and you can agree or not. For many applications, this is very useful because you can utilize your systems to a much higher degree than you would do with worst case expectations. Besides TROPS, there's a second project group, which is called NHTSA. After the beach, it was devised on. The goal here is not real-time, but getting a system with the smallest trusted computing base. You start with a small security kernel and happen to end with a microkernel. You will get a small set of small component servers. The following slides will show an example. Some well-defined interfaces, since you are forced to go through component interfaces, there are higher chances to use IDL compilers and separate concerns properly. And it should be possible to go for application-specific settings of components, so that you just take components into systems that you really need and leave systems components out that are useless. And base technology or base idea of the system is to split the applications and servers in a trusted and a highly secure part and in a less sensitive, convenient part, and use a legacy operating systems to execute the latter. To give you an example, what you would like to do is, if you want to do digital signatures under emails, you want to make sure that your secret key is kept secret under any circumstances, but for displaying the email and composing it, you do not need that much trust to keep the key really secret. You have a couple of security objectives. We need confidentiality. This means no unauthorized access to information. The way to achieve this, of course, is cryptography. Integrity as no unauthorized, unnoticed modification of information. Hash sums and signatures will do the job here. Recoverability, no permanent damage of information. This is a little bit harder, but the most promising way to go is to use duplicate and trusted servers. We have to deal with the situation anyway, since the internet is not trustworthy, and we have to cope with outages. And availability, timeliness of service, you should be robust against denial of service attacks. You have the security objectives. What do we need? We need a secure, trusted booting and trusted path from or to the user, which must ensure that the graphical user interface is trustworthy. Therefore, we developed our own GUI, which is also a protection against Trojan horses. And you need some kind of sealed storage in order to protect sensitive data. You cannot just write it back to the hard disk, because the hard disk could be taken out. So the standard way of doing this is use trustworthy hardware in shape of the upcoming TCG specs and stored into the TPM. We want to support legacy applications and operating systems, because these systems are very valuable when it comes to functionality. Of course, we must use standard hardware. Anything else is just too expensive, and maybe add some up-to-date enhancement like the TPM of the TCG. What we have is we have fine-grained isolation between applications, minimal trusted computing base for trusted applications and services. What we use is in scheme we call trusted weather, where you use, for instance, Linux to drive your file systems, but you just feed in encrypted and signed data. So even Linux might be compromised, but the confidentiality of your data is not violated. A thing to notice is that we want to see it established as an open source alternative to Microsoft NGS CSP, which does basically the same. So if you look at it, there are no really big surprises. You again have the microkernel, in this case a fiasco microkernel at the bottom. You have the minimal secure platform, and this platform is substantially smaller than the Alpha Linux kernel or the Linux system or the BSD system or whatsoever that's running to provide legacy support. And then on top of this trusted minimal secure servers, you have your secure applications, be it an electronic signature or home banking applications. Another example of a security-sensitive application is Microsina, which is a secure microkernel-based system architecture for VPNs, for virtual private networks. So just let's go to the picture. So you have the LM4 microkernel, you have the core systems again, and you have two network stacks, and in order for simplicity, we used initially two instances of Alpha Linux to do the routing and the IP processing, and have a very small trusted viaduct that does the encryption and decryption needed for IPsec. So in the future, there's more lot to come, of course. Work will progress on the NHTSA project. We will also aim at embedded systems. Virtualization has to be addressed somehow. The upcoming technical features of processors require support both for hardware-supported virtualization and multi-core support. And we have some advanced kernel features that mostly relate to communication control, and kernel memory management. And the last feature here is a short demonstration. The whole presentation was given on microkernel-based systems. We have a Linux running here, which for demonstration purposes will run a small X application. And we have native L4 applications running in parallel. And this is since security is so hard to demonstrate, we will go for real time. So what we do is we have a reservation, CPU reservation for the small applets. And of course, it's already slow here, but if we move it, then the X window comes virtually to a halt, so it doesn't get any CPU time anymore. But note that the real-time applets are not affected at all. At least I hope so. Oh no, it's that's bad. So I have to ask. I have to talk to the author. Yeah, but in all the other presentations, the applets kept running well, even under high CPU load. Okay, I will happily take your question. Thank you. So, just note that it's a pure coincidence that we run just one L4 Linux. We could also run two L4 Linuxes and three L4 Linuxes, and for security-related environments where you have, for instance, the categorization of information depending on their level of security, full separated legacy operating system instance would be the way to go.
I have two questions. Question one, regarding the virtualization capabilities, did you benchmark L4 Linux against systems like Xen or other?
We benchmarked Linux, L4 Linux against monolithic Linux running on bare hardware, and we had a slowdown between 5% and 15%. It depends a little bit on the workload, because if you are very compute intensive, you hardly notice any slowdown, and if you have very frequent task switches and syscalls, then the slowdown is a little bit more. We did not benchmark it against Xen yet. Where you have to say that Xen is also not virtualization, but para-virtualization, so it depends a little bit on your scope, what you want to do.
Second question, how do you cope with DMA-capable hardware?
Okay, this is a problem at the moment, and what we did do is we slipped a layer of DMA validation underneath L4 Linux. So one member of the group did a component that traps device access and validates DMA access. This problem of DMA access is not easily resolved without additional hardware support. Because you can circumvent virtual address space isolation by just programming the DMA engines properly and just corrupt the kernel. We hope that upcoming security-related hardware will support a little bit more this endeavor, and you already have some support with 64-bit PCI bridges, which have some kind of IO MMU.
Thank you.
About NHTSA, you wrote that you have a native NHTSA GUI and also an X11 running. How does that relate?
You can see it here. So basically, this GUI is called DOPE, so don't ask me for the reasoning of the scheme. There are two techniques. First of all, the GUI is aware of the contents of its windows. So X has a problem that it does not understand the semantics of the windows content. This is a secure real-time capable GUI has a shared memory region set up between the application and the GUI, so it can make it can ensure progress even if the application does not cooperate. This GUI of this legacy application has no way to corrupt or to emulate the whole screen. You always have secure labeling, and therefore you cannot impersonate a secure service. Does it answer your question? Or?
Yes, thank you.
So what I did not do is, of course, there are there are related projects. What I want to do is here to refer you to the links where you can download a demo CD that you can either run in a virtual machine like VMware or run on Linux if you are interested in the topic and would to volunteer to port BSD onto L4, for instance.
What is the actual state of NHTSA project?
There is a basic architecture in place. You have some example applications for secure email signature, but it needs to be polished. There's an effort underway to get project funding from the federal government. It's not really in the beginning because the main components like the microkernels and the basic servers are here. One important thing that it's missing that it's support for another not so far mentioned legacy operating systems that everybody knows here, which is at the moment not in scope because we do not have source access, so we need to wait for full virtualization support, which is also underway. So we will build full-scale virtual machines into the microkernel systems where you can run unmodified operating system binaries, that what you cannot do so far. It's not very early. It's in the medium stage.
So you still don't have experiences in production environments, as far as I can see.
We have some technical partners. We have ported the system onto a platform that's very similar to one you would find in a cell phone. The Fiasco is deployed in an appliance that has an operating system. There are other L4 versions that are used in the automotive environment, but it's true that we ourselves have no deep experience in production environments, but we are keen to get some. So if you are interested, we would be very glad to talk to you wherever you were. I couldn't see you.
Yeah.
Okay.
What happens if we have two instances of Linux trying to access the network's hardware?
Of course, you have to make sure that the hardware is either partitioned or that these two instances are cooperative. So if you normally what you do is you use one L4 Linux to drive the hardware and start to other many other Linux instances and use virtual devices, so they would just go with network-mounted file systems, and these networks would be provided over virtual networks. But as soon as you can partition the access to the devices, you can run whatever combination you want.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I only know Perso as also an alternative to NHTSA. What are the advantages of NHTSA compared to Perso?
Perso basically is NHTSA. Perso and the NHTSA project are very similar. Perso uses many components that also NHTSA uses. Perso uses an L4 microkernel. It can use both Fiasco and one of the Karlsruhe microkernels, Pistachio. It uses the L4 environment. It has the same objectives. It has the same structure. We have cooperation. So Perseus and NHTSA are more like the two sides of the same metal than two different projects. And in the project applications, these two projects are very closely cooperating. If you want, so yes. So thank you, and please pay the same attention to the coming talks that will go into details of how really build a provable microkernel.